the path for the peace paradigm. King and Gandhi, many more, have discovered something core. Now we're building a path for the peace paradigm. Every challenge is another highway sign.
Welcome, everybody, to Peace Paradigm Radio, a project of the Meta Center for Nonviolence in collaboration with KWMR Community Radio. And today is Friday, January 23rd, 2015. We'll be talking in this show with Joseph Helfenstein, who is the curator of an exhibit in Houston called Experiments with Truth, Gandhi and Images of Nonviolence. And then we'll move into Nonviolence in the News with Michael Negler. And then we have Kit Miller with us, who is joining us from Rochester.
Greetings, everyone. This is Nonviolence in the News for January 23rd. 2015, news that you will not usually get from the mainstream media, and analysis that you won't get anywhere. I think I'd like to start off by mentioning that we are about to enter the season for nonviolence, SNV, the same initials as my co-hostess, Stephanie. And this will be the 18th consecutive year. It will start on January 30th in cities around the globe. More than 900 cities in 67 countries have participated since the campaign began in 1998. And this is basically a consciousness-raising effort to celebrate the efforts of Gandhi and King, who was started by Arun Gandhi, Mahatma Gandhi's grandson. And in fact, I remember having a conversation with him just when we were beginning back then, and I asked him if he was going to propose any specific actions for people or cities to take, and he said he was going to leave that up to the individuals. And so, in fact, you have this amazing outpouring of creativity and events and celebrations. If you go to their well-endowed website or well-furnished website, one of the most interesting things that you'll see is, quote, 64 ways to practice nonviolence. I have a feeling that that's just scratching the surface, but there'd be 64 interesting possibilities. Now, in a neighboring county, Sonoma County, the event I blush to mention, there will be a start off with an award ceremony for your humble servant at Pioneer High School in Santa Rosa. So if you're lucky, come on up there. The evening will begin with a nonviolence training at 5:30, and then there'll be a two-hour celebration, not of me, of a season for nonviolence with a 10-minute talk by myself, which I have not written yet. I'd like to focus a little bit on the fifth anniversary coming up of the disastrous, if I may say so, decision by the Supreme Court called Citizens United, which has injected enormous amounts of money influence into our political culture. Dramatically enough, from our friend Kai Newkirk, who is one of the founders of 99 Rise, an offshoot of Occupy movements, seven courageous 99 Rise leaders followed my example, says Kai, and stood up in the chamber of the United States Supreme Court to interrupt the justices, to speak out against corruption, and call Americans to action to defend our democracy. We, the people, have had enough, was their message, and we will wage escalating nonviolent resistance to challenge this corruption until we end it. That is an extremely courageous and actually, from the point of view of nonviolent dynamics and nonviolent theory, that's exactly correct. That's what you do. You start off trying to negotiate, then you escalate to putting various kinds of pressure to bear, and If you're really committed that this thing has to end, you escalate that pressure until you get it to end. And we believe that if you do your nonviolence correctly, that you will succeed in a nonviolent moment where the purity of your efforts meets the resistance of the oppression. Nonviolence will always prevail, if not in the short term, then in the long term. Another organization, Pachamama, that you may be familiar with, which has been working on climate change and protection of a very important part of the Ecuadorian rainforest for many years, has now added Citizens United to their agenda. And they have a very creative film. That's P-A-C-H-A-Mama, Pachamama Alliance. And Wednesday of this week saw a march and rally in San Francisco, the theme of which was Mourning in America. That's M-O-U-R-N-I-N-G. It was a march and rally to mark the fifth anniversary of the disastrous decision. Also in U.S. news, a very good friend of ours, Kathy Kelly, is on her way to prison today for 90 days for action in protesting drone strikes and drone warfare. I believe there was at Creech Air Force Base. She went in with a loaf of bread and a message for the base commander, and Kathy is going to jail again. If you want to contact her, send her books or anything, you can find her through Voices for Creative Nonviolence in Chicago. Now, I'm trying to keep our news report a little bit brief today because we have not one but two wonderful guests. But I did want to touch on an unusual event that we happened to get a report about from the outside world, and this is from Albania, and from an organization called Operazione Colomba, or the Operation Dove, which is an offshoot of the community of Pope John the 23rd. And although this is a local little thing, it illustrates some principles of nonviolence. What our friends, and we visited them in Rome, what they're trying to do is counteract the culture of Getmarka, which is, I think I'm pronouncing that correctly, it means blood feud. What happened was the Catholic Albanians found themselves more or less isolated in the northern region of the country and found themselves in a situation of a failed state. There basically is no state control in their area. And so they fell back on a system that keeps some sort of control going on, and that system happens to be blood feuds. And so you have a large number of people where the men, young men in particular, can't even go out of the house. And so our friends are doing accompaniment. They're bringing attention to bear for the regional officials and the federal government and giving aid and comfort. And trying to introduce a concept of nonviolence and human dignity to be applied in every conceivable situation. So we'll be reporting to you more about how this interesting experiment is going. Just briefly mention one other brief thing and we'll get over to our guests, and that is that the graduates of an elite Jerusalem high school have called for draft refusal for their classmates. They have signed a letter from dozens of Israeli alumni from the Israel Arts and Sciences Academy saying that Gaza was the straw that broke the camel's back and it's time now to offer resistance. Well, it was difficult for me to make that selection from the many, many things that are going on in the country and in the world, but I think that at least serves to give you a sense.
Thanks so much, Michael. And now let's turn to our next guest, who is Joseph Helfenstein. And he is calling in from Houston, Texas. And he is the curator of an exhibit called Experiments with Truth, Gandhian Images of Nonviolence. And not only of the exhibit, but also he put together a book about the exhibit. And it's in conjunction with an event taking place called Gandhi's Legacy, Houston Perspectives, an Exploration of Tolerance, Diversity, and Peace. Welcome to Peace Paradigm Radio, Joseph.
Hello. Yeah, well, thank you.
Well, it's a great honor to have you here, and we are very interested in what inspired you to curate this exhibit.
Actually, this is a very long story, and I tried to make it short. When I was a teenager, and I'm from Switzerland, I read a lot of books, like we probably all did some decades ago. One of them was Gandhi's autobiography, and I never forgot the photograph, which was one of the photographs, the few ones in that book, which is the photograph of his last possessions, with very few objects, two pairs of sandals, and his glasses, and his watch, and a few books, and a fork, and so on. Very, very few things. I just never forgot that photograph. Then I studied art history and became a curator, and I did my PhD, and I never forgot that photograph. And probably about 20 years ago, I did just kind of decided that I had to try to take that photograph as the inspiration to do a broad thematic show about the visualizations of nonviolence throughout the history of art. And so, long story short, I had many kind of amazing encounters, one of which was on my first job in the U.S. Was at the University of Illinois in Urbana-Champain. I came to the U.S. in the summer of 2000. One of the very first people I met was Gandhi's grandson, Raj Mohan Gandhi, who also was a new professor. And so we met at this reception for new faculty, and we talked. And he then became another one who have had great insights and so on. Many, many other colleagues, academics, artists, and so on, my colleagues here at the Menil, joined in. I went to India in 2009, and anyway, in the end, the exhibition came together. We opened it on Gandhi's birthday, October the 2nd, last year, and it will close this coming February 1st, which is just the day after Gandhi's assassination. So there's the dates of the exhibition, too, have kind of a symbolic meaning. But maybe I should stop talking so you can ask all the questions.
Well, it's very, very interesting. And I'm struck that you had noticed this all sort of started when you saw that photograph of Gandhi's last possessions. And in the culture that we're living in, where there seems to be more of an understanding that we get our power from things that we have. And yet this man had such a great power and such a new form of expressing it through nonviolence. We can ask ourselves, where did that power really come from if it didn't come from his things? And I was wondering if you could talk about that, and how do you express the power of nonviolence in this exhibit that you've curated? You go through, you know, religion and but a lot of other places and poetry. Can you talk about that?
Yes. Yes, that's a great question. Well, in a way, I believe the fact that there were so few objects was certainly a reason why I was captivated, like many others, perhaps. And because that was really sort of that was the complete opposite of what was even I myself was going to through in Switzerland. You know, this was the 70s. Early 70s, I must have been 14 or 15, and it was consumer culture at its highest, you know, wars going on everywhere, apartheid being, you know, getting worse, the Vietnam War at its kind of worst state. I mean, this was a violent, loud world with a lot of, you know, a lot of things that have nothing to do with this photograph or this kind of simplicity. And that's maybe a reason why I was struck by it. Well, if you come to the Menil, there is an opening to the show which kind of indicates the breadth of what I wanted to achieve, which is really to bring this from Gandhi both into the past and into the present. So the first things you actually see before you enter the show is this photograph of Gandhi's last possessions, which is also on the cover of the book that we published. And then you see a beheaded Buddha statue, a heavily vandalized, but still very recognizable and very beautiful ancient Buddha from our own collection. And next to it is the video of the tank man, the anonymous, unknown man who had the courage to step into the street and stop the tanks that were rolling to Tiananmen Square on June the 5th, I think it was, in 1989. So you see that man standing there, and like the Buddha, the same posture, but it's, you know, it's now. This was 89, but in a way it feels very much like now. And so the exhibition integrates both, you know, beautiful works that cover a lot of religious traditions, as well as very concrete things like the civil rights movement, as well as the anti-apartheid movement. And a lot of contemporary living artists have participated over decades. I've had many, many conversations with great artists from South Africa, where this all happened, to the U.S. We have artists from Europe, and we have artists from Asia, of course, from India, South Korea. So it's a very broad and kind of ambitious project, and it's been actually wonderfully successful in terms of response.
Josef, this is Michael Nagler. Will the exhibit go on the road, or can it be brought to other cities?
I wish it would. I've tried. But thanks for asking. It will actually go to Europe. One of the lenders, there's lenders from all over the world, including beautiful loans from, you know, like the L.A. County, from Yale University, from private collectors. But the show is in a way also very site-specific, because we do have the Roscoe Chapel here, which is one of the very few non-denominational kind of sacred spaces in the U.S. that is really dedicated to human rights and tolerance and interreligious dialogue and all these important things. So, and of course, that chapel, which is a very important place of meditation and, you know, a beautiful art space, cannot be, you know, moved, of course. Many other things cannot be transported, but it will go to Europe, and it will be at the International Museum of the Red Cross, which is also an interesting story, because that was founded right before Gandhi was born, and it's probably one of the most important, you know, humanitarian achievements of the 19th century. And the guy who actually founded this was a Swiss businessman from Geneva, who, his name is Henri Dunant. He was so struck by a battle scene in northern Italy in the 19th century that he changed his life, and he dedicated himself. He became a pacifist and founded the International Red Cross, and now Red Crescent. Anyway, they have a museum there with some amazing objects. They just have a new exhibition space. They have lent us a few very fascinating documents, including works made by political prisoners from both Africa and Eastern Europe, and they are also in the show. So the show has, you know, works that are beautiful. I mean, a lot of photography, civil rights, India, and, you know, Cartier-Bresson, and so on, but also very powerful, really, you know, sculptures and paintings, devotional pieces, Buddhist, Jain, Islamic, you know, calligraphies, and of course Christian pieces, and also documents relating to the Judaic tradition. So in a way, you know, it's a little bit idealistic, this whole thing. It took me decades, really, to finish it and do it in a thoughtful way, because it's you can do a lot of naive things here, and these are very tricky and complex issues. We have a beautiful one of the oldest existing manuscripts of the Quran from the 8th century is in the show, in the same room with a Bible, you know, which highlights the Sermon on the Mount, which was both of these, you know, the texts were studied by Gandhi. And of course, both, you know, both traditions talk about things that we all agree, like, you know, tending to the sick and compassion and actually nonviolence. But we tend to focus on, of course, the media world is obsessed with the opposite, which is violence and noise and destruction and bombs and so on.
You know, speaking of that, I'm looking right now at Mel Chin's work, Homiso 9.
Oh, yeah.
And it says it's a self-contained, action-activated, fully functional, self-medicating, emergency gunshot trauma treatment kit. So can you tell us what it is otherwise, and what does it look like, and why is it important?
Yeah, thank you for asking. One thing about the difficulty to visualize nonviolence is that it is very, at the core, of course, there's a kind of a dialectic relationship between violence and nonviolence. You have to overcome violence even in yourself to be really proactively, thoughtfully nonviolent, as you guys all know and do so. That's kind of the beautiful message, you know, core mission that you seem to have. So in a way, the relationship between violence and nonviolence is a key theme in the show. There's very powerful works from both ancient and modern, and that one is an extremely important one. Mel Chin is a living, you know, American artist. Actually, grew up in Houston. He has actually now a touring big retrospective. This is the most often used street gun in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. Tens of thousands of people must have been killed with that gun called Glock. And he took that gun, bought it at a gun dealer, and emptied the content, the inner life of this thing, the gun, and replaced it with a first aid kit for gun wounds. So you see the gun, you know, as it is. You can buy that thing everywhere in the U.S., certainly. And you see the first aid kit in a vitrine next to it. It's a piece that is very important to me, has always been. This artist has been very important to me. He's one of the many I've discussed this project for many, many years. And the funny thing is, this is an object that is at the Whitney Museum of American Art, so it's in a very famous collection. And the Whitney was very nice. They, you know, I begged them to lend, and they did. And so, like 10 days before the opening of the show, we received a phone call from the transport companies telling us that, unfortunately, the piece could not be brought to Houston. And the reason being the gun laws of the state of Texas being not compatible with the gun laws of the state of New York. And I couldn't believe it. So I immediately called the artist, and he said, well, I have a solution. Let me call the gun dealer I worked with when I bought this thing. I call him. He's in New York, and he did. And he said, what we can do is the museum can bring this piece, which is not it's not a gun anymore, to this gun dealer's place. He can ship it to a gun dealer in Houston, and we can pick it up. Now, it's not that easy among museums. You know, we would not do that as a museum ourselves. We would not give it something, that's not a way you can professionally transport works of art. So the Whitney refused, and so the only thing we could do is the artist, Mel Chin, did replace, so we could get the more difficult to redo part, the first aid kit part, and the artist had to buy another of these guns and do that little work that's needed to complement the piece. So in the end, the piece was, you know, I'm so happy we have it in the show. It arrived on the day of the opening, it's just one of the many stories that relate to this project.
Wow. That's amazing.
What an odyssey. And it really helps us appreciate the amount of effort and thought that you've put into this. Yosef, and I did want to point out that we do have some meditation spaces here in California.
Sure. So if you wanted to bring that. Yeah, very much so. Yeah. Of course.
I appreciate very much the fact that while taking Gandhi as a point of departure, you are looking at nonviolence more broadly and bringing in meditation and the spiritual dimension. I want to tell a little story. You start with this, how much it struck you, the simplicity of Gandhi's outward possessions. You may be quite aware of this, but when he was in prison toward the end of his life in the Aga Khan's palace, he had a regime where he was eating, I think, 9 almonds a day. That was a large part of his diet. And the person who was with him thought, well, you know, the old man, he'll never notice. He slipped in a few extra almonds and gave him 12. And Gandhi ate them without comment. And he thought, see, it worked. And the next morning, Gandhi quietly said, I will only have 6 today because I had 12 yesterday.
Yeah, that's Gandhi. Yeah. There's so many stories and so many. And yes, there's nothing to say.
Well, I think
beautiful story.
What I got from that is an insight that Gandhi was probably trying to live on the absolute minimum that would sustain life and not take one scrap more. And so his whole life was an experiment, and that was part of the experiment.
Yes. Thank you for saying this. Yeah, that's why we also choose the title Experiments with Truth, Gandhi and Images of Nonviolence, because, of course, truth, you know, everyone defines truth his or her own way and should do so. And so, there's a certain, suspicion in the art world to even talk about truth because art is sort of above truth or supposed to be. So it's an interesting kind of a challenge. And yes, it has been, for me, the most difficult part. This has been a difficult project to realize because nonviolence is a concept. It's an idea. It's lived a mostly very courageous experience. How do you visualize that? But there are ways to visualize it, and you know, there are themes in almost every religion. There's, you know, in Buddhism, we have a goddess of compassion. The Green Tara is a very, very, very beautiful masterpiece. Is in the show, for example, and we have this beautiful print by Rembrandt where Christ is healing the sick. It's an absolute masterpiece of the history of printmaking. It's a very famous print called the 100 Guilder print. So that is in the show, and I mentioned the Quran. There's also a beautiful calligraphy and other and some miniatures, Sufi related miniatures, and of course there are Jain pieces. And so there's a very rich visual, I don't know, vocabulary, or you know, there are many different iconographies of visualizing or discussing nonviolence. And what I've tried is to bring them together and to kind of create kind of a dialogue without telling people what to think. So it's an unusual showing that there's very little wall text or none, but the book is important. The book gives you a lot of background and a lot of text and a lot of thinking and many essays and poems and so on.
Yosef, thank you so much for joining us here on Peace Paradigm Radio today. There are so many more questions that we could ask you. For example, I would love to go more in depth into the work of Susan Fraycom and her more modern pieces and how you visualize that as a part of the exhibit. Do you have somewhat of a short answer to share about her, the more modern pieces and how they fit in?
Susan Fraycom is an artist whose work relates in many ways, but indirectly to this. First of all, she is a great kind of admirer of Islamic architecture. She's a great reader. She is a big has admired Rumi for many years, and has the paintings and watercolors in the show. The watercolors are made on Indian paper, on a very kind of old paper, and they all relate to titles of Rumi poems. They are like ancient manuscripts, but they're contemporary works on paper. There's also a painting called Dust that is also related to Rumi. So in her case, it's the Rumi connection. Rumi is also one of these great, great figures, like, in a way, like St. Francis, you know, of Assisi. They kind of lived at the same time, you know, amazingly. You have these figures who had this very broad vision and kind of idealism in terms of bringing people together rather than, you know, antagonizing them and polarizing the world. So that has been a very, very long tradition, and of course the exhibition tries to relate to that also with contemporary artists, as I said, who really have been very, very passionate about this show. I feel very lucky about this whole project.
Well, it's such a great gift and that you've given to the world with this exhibit. So thank you so much for all of your dedication and time and intelligence that went through this. And I'm so glad as well that you created this book of it. So I think that everybody should have this in their on their coffee table to, you know, to look through, to learn about nonviolence through the visual arts, which is amazing. Especially those who are that have nonviolence centers and peace centers and so forth. This seems to be a great piece of that collection. And it's published through Yale, which is amazing. So, Joseph, thank you so much for joining us on Peace Paradigm Radio. And we hope that you will stay in touch and join us again.
It's been an honor. Thank you so much for doing what you all do. Thank you.
My latest sun is sinking fast. My race is nearly run. My strongest trials now are past. My triumph has begun. Oh, come, angel band, come and around me stand. Oh, bear me away on your snow-white wings to my immortal home. Oh,
to Peace Paradigm Radio, collaboration between KWMR and the Meta Center for Nonviolence. And we have here in the studio with us Kit Miller from Rochester, New York, and the M.K. Gandhi Institute for the Study of Nonviolence. Welcome, Kit.
Thank you.
You've been on the show before. You've talked to us about Badshah Khan and the work of the Gandhi Institute. Can you give us a short overview again of what the Gandhi Institute does before we jump into our conversation with you today, which we were hoping would be a little bit of a Hope Tank style conversation about some pressing issues.
Sure, I'm happy to, but mostly I'm just glad to be in your company again. It's I feel like I come out here to be refueled by you guys and the work that you do, and we're so fueled far away across the country by the work that you do, and I bounce people over to the MediCenter website all the time, and there's so many things I feel like we don't have to worry about that because they're doing it. So I just want to appreciate the partnership, which is often silent but doesn't have to be today. So I just want to thank you.
Thank you.
The focus that we have, you know, ended up pursuing in Rochester has been more related to developing nonviolence with people between the ages of 12 and 24 and those who serve them. That's a primary focus in all the programming that we do, and when all the requests come in for us to do different kinds of things, that's how we sort it. So we try to focus on that. So our primary audience for us initially was college students. Very grateful that the Gandhi Institute is sponsored in part by the University of Rochester. So I started off my job 5.5 years ago thinking about, okay, how do I share nonviolence with college students, which is a And, of course, so many extraordinary nonviolent movements have often been initiated by people in that age group, so it felt very exciting to think about how to share nonviolence with people of that age. And then that sort of naturally led for us into noticing that when we brought college students into high school students got very engaged because there's this sort of, like, inevitable social dynamic that happens that people who are a few years older than you when you're young, you can't help but think that they're kind of cool. Especially when they're passionate. So we started, you know, noticing the effects that passionate college students had on high school students. So then we started these nonviolence clubs and doing them both in urban and suburban settings. And then last year what happened in one city school in Rochester, which has unfortunately one of the worst profiles nationally for both poverty as well as graduation rates, especially for young men of color, we got such a good feedback from what the high school kids did with the middle school kids that one of the schools in particular said to us, gee, can you do the work with middle school kids all summer? So I had high school kids and some 20-somethings working with middle school kids all summer. At the end of August, the school said to us, can you teach social justice to what 80 middle school kids a day this year? And you have a week to pull it together. And that's what we're doing now.
So you said, sure.
We did. We did. It was a wild scramble. So what we're doing right now, a lot of focus on, so we're working 5 classes a day in one school, working with highly at-risk youth, which is one of those words I don't love, but that's the way that we talk about these young folks. And then we have another school that's also reached out to us, so we're doing a little bit of that then, but we hit capacity. Then we, at the high school level, we're working with the nonviolence clubs in urban and suburban settings and then continuing our college programming. So as far as our education work, that's a primary focus.
Yeah, I really like that, too, that the way that you have evolved and seeing that, okay, what do we do with college students? How do we work on nonviolence with college students? And you find out that the core of it is service.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's follow the thread of service, and the thread of service brings us to learning to be teachers of a subject ourselves. And they say that when you teach something, that's when you really learn it, too.
Right.
So it's still... you're still affecting that college education portion as well, which
Absolutely.
I think is great.
Yep.
You know, Kate, I was once doing a talk on nonviolence in Casa Grande High School here up in Petaluma, and one of the young ladies in the class said to me, this is all very nice, but you're going to have to start with the younger age group. Mm-hmm. She was 17. It was too late already.
People say that all the time to us, and I say I recognize it, but I also want to be seen for what I'm doing with the inputs that I have. You know, yeah. With a handful of young people and under 300,000 a year, you know, this is what we're able to do. Yeah. And I just want to be seen for we have limits. And so I don't disagree that working with kids starting at age 5 or age 3 would be better. And as soon as folks step forward and help making those resources available, then we'll start doing it. Yeah. But I want people to just not recognize that miracles cannot happen, too.
Well, Stephanie is teaching in a Montessori school, so she'll
I'm be working. I went early. I went ages 3 to 6, and it's been so between all of us at these nonviolence education centers, we've got the spectrum covered.
Sweet.
You can tell people that.
I feel relieved. Good, glad to hear it. Next time someone says, "How do I find nonviolence curriculum for preschoolers, I'll point them in your direction.
Send them my way.
Yeah.
The other thing that we've really gotten involved in Rochester, you know, was I had a keen interest from when I worked out here in the Bay Area in restorative justice and restorative practices. I think of it as a structural approach to nonviolence and utterly in keeping with, you know, anything around building beloved community. And it's been really a pleasure, especially to be working in the Western New York region, which is, you know, where the Iroquois Confederacy was centered, to, you know, get feedback at times from different people from the Native American culture saying, but, you know, basically, this is us. This is our way of doing things. We wouldn't throw people away even if we could. We never did. We never would. So it's been an interesting process to also be involved with a movement in the city of Rochester and the surrounding suburbs to share the idea of restorative practices. And that really led us very quickly and directly into needing to deal with issues of racism, because Rochester is officially like a hyper-segregated community due to its housing and education patterns and some of the worst poverty and graduation rates, as I said earlier. And these things are all connected with each other. So a lot of my time, actually, almost 25% almost now, is actually spent on issues of race and race dialogues, including now a couple of projects with suburban police in the area, looking at how do we, like, do a better job not targeting black and brown people who live in the suburbs of the city. So it's been very organic in terms of a lot of the programming.
Well, that's certainly timely.
Yeah.
Kit, I wanted to ask you, what is your sense of the situation nationwide? Are there other programs that are or are not affiliated with universities and, you know, the King and Gandhi type of institutes? I have the feeling that they've been growing.
I think so. I mean, I know I actually just had an undergrad from University of Washington do reach out to us, who's working with one of our colleagues who teaches Kingian nonviolence that we've partnered with. So I do hear about that a little bit. I just want to actually just continue to mourn limitations. I mean, we're just so busy where we are. We have folks come and visit us. I just talked this morning with someone from Wagner College in Staten Island. They asked us to come down because of what happened with Eric Garner down there.
Yeah.
Is sending still enormous, of course, waves through the undergraduate population there. So, you know, responding to these requests, you know, we'll do as much as we can, but we're finding that there's just never enough hours in the day. So.
Yep.
So I really work hard in looking at what can I do mindfully, thoughtfully with the inputs that we have, and not because, you know, you guys know this very, very well. I mean, this is overwhelming at times to think about, and people get so excited. But how much can we do and live to tell the tale?
You know, and this idea of the need for self-care always comes up for me, and it's something that I've been extra busy lately, and I love it. I love how that I'm basically reined in to service. You know, I can sleep or I can serve. and then I can try to get in trouble on Sundays. But usually I'm trying to do my laundry on that day. And I found that making sure that I have a ritual around my mealtimes has been very, very important. Something simple like that, like setting out my place in the evening for my breakfast in the morning where I'll sit for at least 15 minutes and sip a cup of tea and be at peace for a moment before I jump into the day, as opposed to picking up my tea or coffee and walking around and trying to get things in order. And similarly, you know, in the evening as well, to sit down after a long day for, you know, even if it's a short period of time, 20 minutes, but to be able to sip a glass of water for 5 minutes, as opposed to trying to guzzle it down. And I just see those things as really related, as how busy we are. Then what do we do to bring out that sense of peace within those very, very busy times? And so my thumb throwing out there is rituals around meals, taking that time. It was a really new feeling for me of, wow, this is a time that's just for me, and I can use it to breathe, and I don't need to do other things at this time.
Hmm. Well, you know, that brings up the question of mindfulness and meditation, and I was very pleased to see that that's a part of your nonviolence clubs.
Mm-hmm.
Could you talk about that, Kit? How do you bring that in? How do the kids respond?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I will, and I also want to say that the Institute right now, one of these days, you guys have got to come out and visit, because the Institute is located in a formerly abandoned house. And I actually, sometimes when I do presentations, I show people one of the bullets that we dug out of the side of the house when we rehabbed it. And in a neighborhood where, like, just this past weekend, there was a shooting, which concerns me because a lot of the guys that work for me, live within a few doors of the house. So, we're crunched for space increasingly, and we have a meditation room. And for a little while, we were like, maybe we really can't afford this meditation space. We really need the space. And so we moved a little conference table in there. And like for 8 hours, I sat there and I was like, get it out of there. We have to have a meditation space. It has to be central. It has to be the point and part of that. We can't fake this stuff. So I'd say that everybody, and I'm so blessed. I'm definitely the old crone who works at the Gandhi Institute. Everybody else is 19 up to like 29, actually, is the age range of everybody that works there. One person is a whopping 33. And they, all of them have some sort of somatic or mindfulness practice. And those who don't, when they get there, are strongly encouraged and led by their peers to move towards that. And I think that that's been a kind of a very natural thing. So I think my guys share those concepts in whatever way. So some of them it's meditation. Some of them it might be more of a somatic practice of some sort. I think they try to use skillful means. For some kids, sitting still is what they're forced to do all day long. So our little time with them, our 50 minutes with them that day, actually what's more supportive and loving is a somatic practice of some kind, which like allows them to, you know, release some of that energy through movement. So it's quite varied what we do.
It reminds me, on the wall in the school that Stephanie teaches at, there's a little placard that says, meditate 20 minutes a day, unless you're too busy, in which case meditate an hour.
Yeah, something along those lines.
We are also very keen on restorative justice, and we have a theory that it could be made to happen in the schools.
Mm-hmm.
That's vulnerable. That's actually going on. And we had four young people from Santa Rosa High School in here talking about their restorative justice.
Wonderful.
In their school. And from establishing it in the schools, we feel it would be a relatively doable step to get it into the criminal justice system. Hard but doable. And then once you got that, of course, you could move on the war system or whatever.
The data is there. I mean, I think, like, you know, it's so funny, like, what data we choose to pay attention to in this country and what mm-hmm. we don't. You know, so much is like, well, it has to be research-based. And I'm skeptical of that because I think that's actually an agenda in part to keep the grassroots moan very short. But I'm also interested in the places where we do have data, like Erica Chenoweth's data or the data on restorative justice that indicates that it's much more effective, that recidivism rates are much better, that it's so much less expensive than the current, you know, recidive or the current justice system. So I feel quite insistent about continuing to point that out. It was one of the things that I annoy people with at home in Rochester because, you know, it was again, it's a city that people talk about data all the time. But it was actually after the shootings at Columbine, which, as you know, you probably know, was an affluent suburb of Denver, that was the pretext for putting metal detectors in our urban schools. And I think that's probably true in other cities as well. And what I point out to these people who have authority is I said, if you really wanted to be research-driven, we would have put the metal detectors in the suburbs and left the urban kids, because there still hasn't been a mass shooting in an urban school in this country.
I want to say that I think that the state and the structures that are currently in place are very aware of the revolutionary power of restorative justice. Because I was in a conversation recently with somebody who works at the Pentagon who's also related to me. And I was trying to think of ideas to discuss that wouldn't be too political or too agitating, you know, just because
like the weather,
like but you know, a little bit like, oh, have you heard about restorative justice? Isn't that interesting? Versus getting into an argument about something else. And it turned out to be very contentious for us to talk about, where his response became, you know, I don't know, is it better to scare people to not commit crime anymore, or is it better to invest all of our resources into rehabilitating them? And what would you have said to my uncle when he said that to me, who was just very clear that, oh, well, we've given it some thought, and it's, you know, the research is still out whether which one is more effective?
Well, I mean, my usual move when I'm speaking to people with structural power is to empathize with them for the position that they're holding. So, you know, like, so it sounds like you're also worried about really making sure that we create systems and structures that are most effective, you know, and like those, and like find the common ground. And then I would say, so I'm glad to hear it because I feel the same way. And I just want you to know that I've actually seen data that's different from what you've just quoted. And I've seen data that suggests that restorative justice is more effective and that actually the current retributive system doesn't actually successfully prevent crime. It actually creates criminals. And I'd be interested if you ever heard of any of that, or would you be open to even seeing any of it? Because, you know, you have a position that's important in this country, and it would be cool for us to be able to continue to talk.
Mm-hmm.
That's a really good answer.
Mm-hmm.
Kit, you know, I taught a course. I gave a class at right down here at our federal prison. Mm-hmm. And I was part of a series going on. And I was told that the group of men who were taking that course had been followed for some years. And by the way, these were 16 years to life. Mm-hmm. So these were mostly homicidal people in San Quentin there. And they had a recidivism rate of 2.5%, where the national average was in the 70s, just by being treated like human beings.
Yeah, yeah. We've had a lot of that experience, too. Mm-hmm. You know, when you talk about the Season for Nonviolence earlier, we have a lot of Season for Nonviolence activities in Rochester. And the place that most inspires me about the Season for Nonviolence around us is actually in Groveland Prison, which is a medium security facility just down the road from us, about an hour away. And they have they've invited Arun Gandhi the last few years, and they did a gun buyback program down there. You know, and a lot of these guys, I mean, they know perfectly well. We have so much leadership locked up in this country that really saddens me. Can I tell you guys about one project that I'm so excited about?
Police.
Of course.
So one thing that I'm working on that hopefully when next I sit with you, it'll be a reality above the ground, is that we're creating a greenhouse. We have an acre of ground next to the Gandhi Institute, and we're creating a greenhouse that, because of my study of permaculture, which I think of as another applied nonviolence structure, is going to do several things. It's going to be generate a couple hundred pounds of organic produce a month in a neighborhood that the USDA considers a food swamp. That's not that it's a food desert. It's not that there's no food. It's just that there's no good fresh food, or it's expensive or wilted. Second thing, it's going to be a youth employment project in a neighborhood where it's just impossible for the kids to find jobs. You just can't find jobs in these neighborhoods. Like, get it to your head. I've personally taken a couple kids under my wing to try to find them work with all my connections. And I can't find kids work it's just so hard. And the third thing it's going to do is going to be an off-the-grid structure that is going to be a teaching place for, like, we have about 1,000 visitors a year now comes to the Institute. And where we wanted to teach people about systems, because I think, by and large, we tend to be kind of bad systems thinkers in this country. Mm-hmm. So we want the building itself to teach people about systems, like ecological systems, and what are the consequences of imbalance ecologically, and then also social systems. What are the consequences of social imbalance? And I'm excited because it's going to be a youth employment project, and I'm imagining young, you know, men and women from this neighborhood are going to be teaching white college students about systems thinking. That's the goal. And that it'll be beautiful. So that's a big thing I'm working on right now. I'm super excited about.
What you said reminded me as well of something that I heard from Julia Butterfly Hill, that we live in a culture that is suffering from attention deficit disorder and collective amnesia. Mm-hmm. And that's really the where we find ourselves.
Yeah. I mean, I have a lot of compassion. It's a very overwhelming and challenging time to be alive. And for people that haven't found, like, what nourishes them or what helps them to keep their ground in this time, of course, there's, like, a million things that we can do to be distracted and to numb our pain. So I'm so glad for the work that you guys do, you know, and for the work of other people, because we need to find each other and hold each other's hands, because, you know, the future isn't written yet. But the more people that get involved with trying to do something to make it positive, the better.
Well, that's what Roadmap is about,
that
interconnection. And I wanted to just say briefly, we had a talk with a dean who was dead set against restorative justice, and he completely turned around. And so he was asked what made the difference. And he said, every time I did the normal system, I lost a relationship. Every time I do restorative justice, I gain a relationship.
When we use these, we're doing these race dialogues projects in the community in Rochester and in the libraries. We've done them for about 3 years now with a host of community partners. About 1,000 people now have gone through the dialogues. And I recently had an administrator from a school in the suburbs call me and say, I had a kid who was involved in a racial incident. Can you help me think of like a learning opportunity for this kid? And I said, sure. We've got a race dialogue coming up in February in your town. Let this kid become someone who advertises that throughout the community. Let him go as a volunteer and be a participant in the dialogue, and then let him write you and me 500 to 1,000 words after about what he learned. And he was like, perfect. So it's fun to start having the like word out more generally, because people are wanting to explore what does restorative justice mean? Mm-hmm. Because especially for educational institutions, it's so coherent that you learn from your mistakes, not just your academic ones, but also your social ones.
Yeah. So with regard to the microfarm, I was thinking when you do something nonviolent, it tends to ripple out in positive ways that you haven't even planned. Mm. And so you've been talking about three different things that we'd be doing all at once with that farm. And that, to me, that's a clear sign that this is the right thing to do, and it's a nonviolent thing to do. And I bet that there will be more benefits that we haven't even dreamt of. So next year this time, Kit, let's talk about them.
Yes. Yeah. Thank you. I look forward to it.
Earlier in the show, we spoke with Joseph Heffelstein about the Experiments in Truth exhibit at the Mennell Collection in Houston. And in that book, he quotes from Kabir and Rumi and Gandhi and a lot of people. And I wanted to end it with this translation of a Kabir poem it's actually translated by Linda Hess, who we know, and it's called Two Gods. Brother, tell me, where did your two gods come from? Tell me, who made you mad? Ram, Allah, Keshav, Karim, Hari, Hazrat, so many names, so many ornaments, all one gold. It has no double nature. For conversation, we make two, this Namaz, that Puja, this Mahadev, that Muhammad, this Brahma, that Adam. This is a Hindu, that a Turk, but all springs from the earth, Vedas, Qurans, all those books, those mullahs and those Brahmins. So many names, but the pots are all one clay. Kabir says no one can find Ram. Both sides are lost in schisms. One slaughters goats, one slaughters cows. They squander their birth in isms. Till the next time, everybody, take care of one another.
And away he flew to the east, to the west, to the north, to the south. Oh, tell me, didn't it rain? Oh, yeah.
Rain, oh, my Lord. Didn't it? Oh, didn't it? Oh, didn't it? Oh, my Lord. Didn't it rain?
Well, it rained 40 days, 40 nights without stopping. Lord got word when the rain kept dropping. Sent out a raven, sent out a dove. Water, good God, came down from above. Tell me, my God, when it started to rain, women and children, they begin to scream. Knocked on the windows, battered the doors. Cried, oh, no, I can't take no more. No, say, no, no, my friend. God got the key and you can't get in. Just listen. It's raining in the north, in the south, in the east, in the west. Some crying, some moaning. Uptown, downtown. Some weeping, some wailing. Some cry, some moan. On the rich, on the poor. Uptown, kept raining. Cross town, everywhere. Well, the water kept dropping. And the rain kept falling. It's the water kept falling. And the water kept dropping. Some cry, hang over.
Tell me that rain, oh yeah,
rain, oh my Lord.